Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tasha Chaparis. Joining me on the show this week is criminal justice reporter Diane Solise.
Hi, Tasha.
Federal courts reporter Kevin Krause.
Hello.
And breaking news reporter Naheed Rajwani.
Hey there.
Our show today is centered on heroin. We'll discuss a new effort in the Grapevine Police Department to treat heroin use as addiction rather than a crime, and the plot to inject heroin into a 19-year-old Ryan Ashley to steal $3,500. And later on the show, we'll talk to Ryan's dad, Joseph Lashley, about Good Samaritan laws. Let's get started. The Grapevine Police Department is expected to start a nationwide initiative next month to treat drug addiction as a disease rather than a crime. Diane, what is the Police-Assisted Addiction Recovery Initiative, and what does it do?
It's a sea change in the way we in the U.S. approach the war on drugs. And it is acknowledgement by police departments that addiction is a disease and not a crime necessarily. In the past, it's been treated solely as a crime and people get locked behind bars. And the police chief in Grapevine has said that we just have to quit incarcerating sick people. And so this program was started initially in a Boston suburb and Gloucester, and they have a horrible heroin and opioid problem there in much of the Northeast. And they decided that they needed to get people into treatment and also to learn more about what some call a miracle drug called naloxone or Narcan. And it can reverse a heroin overdose or partially reverse a heroin overdose. And people in the drug treatment business have known about this drug for years. And so have ER doctors, and now police officers as well are learning more about it.
So what exactly does it do? I mean, if someone, how do you catch someone at the right time to give them the drug?
Well, that's the critical question, right? The police department, or in the case of Dallas, the fire department, they have the drug with them, and they can either inject somebody or give them it nasally. And they would, of course, have to be there at the right time. Some people in this whole movement to rethink addiction are saying that more people should have it. I believe there is even a school district back east that now has it on their campus. That's how horrible the heroin epidemic has become over there.
So if a paramedic responds and say, I'm clearly having some kind of overdose, they would then inject me or give me that nasally that drug to prevent it? Or how? When is it given? When can someone get access to it?
They'd have to know that. I believe they would have to know what you had OD'd on.
Okay, so my friend says, she was shooting up heroin,
And I don't know quite what happens when they don't know whether it's, say, cocaine, which is not an opioid, or when they clearly see that somebody has taken Oxycontin or Vicodin. Or a cocktail with heroin and those opioids.
So that's when the drug could be used, when they've taken those.
That's when that drug can be used, yeah. And it's non-addictive.
So what Grapevine Police is doing then is, instead of putting people in jail, they're sending them to rehab. What's going on there?
Well, the police chief has told me that they've joined the program that is called PARI, or the Police Assisted Addiction Recovery Initiative.
Right.
They've joined it, but they're still in the process of working out the details of what it will consist of, what treatment centers will be part of the initiative in Grapevine. But they're clearly committed, and there's some very, very human stories that they can tell about why they moved in this direction and how heartbreaking it was to deal with parents or people that they knew and even cared for and saw the spread of heroin use in what's, you know, a tiny community, relatively tiny community, but right next to Dallas and and the dealer community.
Right, right. It's part of the much larger area.
It is. And they're the first in Texas to join this initiative. But there are a lot of people now talking about rethinking how we approach this. And police are a crucial component.
Right. So I imagine that a lot of other police departments might be watching Grapevine in the coming months to see how that program is doing.
I would think so.
Yeah. Ryan Lashley was a talented singer and artist, known to sing Disney tunes on road trips with her mom. She was a graduate of Booker T. Washington High School for the Performing and Visual Arts here in Dallas, and she was given a full ride to Louisiana State University to study opera, but she didn't go. This is clearly a girl with a great life ahead of her, so what went wrong?
Parents have their own theories. They say that her boyfriend Adam's death in early January was what led to her downward spiral. Essentially, she walked in one day and found him dead in their apartment, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But that it seems like that death really rocked her and shook her and forced her to meet other people. And one of them was Catherine Dirks, who is now facing a prison sentence for her death.
So, Kevin, you covered the federal trial of several people involved in basically a scheme that led to Ryan's death. Can you speak a little bit more about what exactly happened?
Yeah, absolutely. This was actually a robbery plot. She found herself in this unfortunate situation. She was in Timberlawn because of some trouble she was having over her boyfriend's suicide. And that's where as Nahid said, that's where she met Kat Dirks. And they became friends, and Kat, unfortunately, had a very long history of substance abuse. She was working as a stripper. She was dating a drug dealer, the dealer who provided the heroin in this case. And so they all met. Ryan met several of these people on the day she died at an IHOP in Plano. And they were Ryan was talking about a trip to Florida that she was planning. She was still distraught at this stage, and she decided to try heroin. So Kat's boyfriend, Jimison Coleman, who was known as J-Mo, sold her some. Now, she had never tried heroin before, and this was some of the most potent heroin in the country. It was called China White. China White, and it hailed from Chicago, not found in Texas. Coleman was the only one who sold it in Texas. And so she took this, well, she was injected three different times with this heroin. And unfortunately, then she overdosed.
So she knew that they were going to inject her the first time, right?
Yeah, she did want to try this. She did not know that there was a plot hatched to rob her. She had $3,500 that she had taken from her dad for this Florida trip, as well as a cell phone and an iPad. And so while they were at the IHOP, J-Mo, Kat, and a third person, Sierra Rounds, noticed the money and the other things she had. And it was then, shortly after that, that they decided that they would rob her by shooting her up with heroin.
So she was found that day by John Davenport in his house, dead.
She was still that. She was in that position the whole time.
Oh, she was dead when I got home, for sure.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I may have gone and glanced at it. Right? I know I did. I mean, I glanced at it. Right? My house is tiny, you know. So I was like, I made a point. I'll tell you this honestly. I made a point not to stare at her because I knew she was dead.
Oh, okay.
And at that point, I'm just trying to, like, wrap my mind on the fact that I just went to work and I'm coming home to go to prison because Sarah has killed somebody in my house. You know, that's all I'm thinking is, like, this is not happening.
So, Kevin, you know, John comes home and sees this girl basically comatose, dead, on his couch. What is the reaction at this point?
Well, you know, he met this girl real briefly before he went to work that day, that morning. And, you know, he was expecting that they would be halfway to Florida by the time he got home. And he comes home and he sees Sierra Rounds rooting through Ryan's car, the stuff everywhere. he walks in and he sees, you know, Ryan on the couch, and he thinks that this initially that she just passed out and was sleeping it off. And but then he started noticing some strange things in the house. And you know, and I have to say about John, John was very important in this case because he was the one who alerted detectives to the fact that just things were not right here. Sierra Rounds had told police it was a suicide. She was trying to cover up this the fact that she injected Ryan. And John was like, no, that's not what happened. He talked to the detectives, and because of him, they really started looking into this as a potential homicide.
So initially, it looks like there's a girl who was using heroin and she just OD'd. And unfortunately, that happens a lot.
But, absolutely.
But Davenport was the one who was like, no, they were taking advantage of her.
Right, right. He absolutely, you know, he spoke up to the detectives, and he has been an advocate. You know, he barely knew this girl, but he really, and he said, you know, he told me that after talking to her parents and friends and learning more about her, it's really affected him. And he feels like kind of like I do. Like that he knew her, and when he found out what a great person she was, so positive, so friendly, so loving, the fact that she died on his couch, he still feels guilty to this day, even though he shouldn't, that he allowed them to use his house to get high. In hindsight, he says, you know, that if he could go back, he wouldn't have allowed it because it may have saved her life.
Right. And so here he is again talking about the robbery plot, how it wasn't about drugs.
This whole thing was a set up robbery of a naive young girl, and drugs were the weapon. You know, this was an aggravated assault turned homicide, and drugs were the weapon to me. You know, this was not like drug use. This is not, to me, even about drug use.
So let's go back a little bit to where things kind of went wrong for Ryan. It was after she found her boyfriend hanging in their apartment that her mom noticed that things were about to change for her.
She's lost now. That's it. This, you don't, nobody finds their boyfriend hanging like that and isn't just severely affected for the rest of their lives. At that moment, driving down 183, I thought, oh my God, this is it. She's going to be in therapy for the rest of her life. Nothing is going to take this away. She's never going to be able to not have that image in her head.
So Nahid, can you explain a little bit what happened after her boyfriend's death and what happened in Timberlawn where she met Kat Dirks?
Sure. So the night that Adam was found hanging in their apartment, Ryan had been locked out of the apartment, so she ended up actually climbing in through a window, seeing him hanging in their door frame. And that really struck with her because it was an image that not only was striking to her, she didn't expect it to happen, but it also made her feel guilty. She'd gone earlier that night to have dinner with her mom, who was working nearby, and she often told her mom, I mean, if she just hadn't gone to dinner, maybe things would be different. So she carried a lot of guilt with her in the weeks that followed this suicide. And Ryan was actually really excited to go into therapy. She knew that she needed help, and her parents had really grown up. They read parenting books. They knew basically how they had an idea of how they wanted to raise their daughter. And suddenly they found themselves confused. They realized they needed help from another place. So the next morning they took her to a therapist that Monica, the mother, had been seeing as well. So they had established a relationship with her. And the therapist happened to be working at Timberlawn, so they decided, okay, you know, our daughter really needs some long-term care. Let's send her to Timberlawn. And Ryan was really excited about going to Timberlawn. She'd gone shopping a few days before with her stepmom to buy some new comfortable clothes. She was up and ready to go the morning they left for Timberlawn. And when they got there, they're waiting in the waiting room, and the mother tells me, you know, there's some people being brought in kicking and screaming, and Ryan just looks at me and goes, what did I get myself into? She's kind of having these second thoughts. And the mom goes, it's okay. You're going to be in a different unit. You don't have to put up with that. And Ryan was sent to the trauma unit at Timberlawn, which is a psychiatric hospital in Dallas. And there she was introduced to Catherine Dirks, who she befriended immediately, it seems like. They got really close. Catherine, it seems as though she opened up to Ryan about her past and wanted to get away with people like Coleman and Ryan, as giving and as compassionate as she was, she decided to take on Kat's role, Kat's case, and help her get out of the situation that she was in. So their relationship kind of evolved from there, and you can tell that even when Ryan returned home, her parents said she seemed normal, like she seemed better, she seemed to be coping with Adam's death, but then she was talking about this girl named Kat, and that's when things kind of took a turn, and the parents started noticing that maybe Ryan was hanging out with a crowd that wasn't necessarily for her, that maybe she was out of her league.
And it's worth noting that her parents were very young when Ryan was conceived and didn't stay together, but continued to work together as co-parents. And one of the things that I was struck with in reading y'all's story, going more in depth into Ryan's life, is that she had this history of taking in strays, and not just stray animals, but stray people. Can y'all talk a little bit about what she was like as a person and why she might have been drawn to someone like Kat Dirks?
Well, yeah, I mean, everything I've heard from talking to people who knew her was that she was extremely generous. She had a lot of empathy for people who've been through tough times, especially after she went through depression after what happened to her boyfriend. And so she was always trying to help people. And, you know, her mom wishes that perhaps she hadn't been as helpful. And, you know, maybe it was a little bit of youthful, you know, naivete there as well. But, you know, she just was, everyone said, I mean, even Kat Dirks, who was convicted of the drug crimes in connection with her murder, said on the witness stand in tears that she was so sweet and that she missed her and loved her. And so no one has really said anything bad about her.
So what did ultimately happen to the three people involved in her death?
Right. All three of them pled guilty, and they were sentenced to multiple years behind bars, more than a decade each of them got. And they're appealing it, but looks like they're going to be in prison there is no parole in federal court, so
right.
Maybe with some good behavior, they may get out a year or a year and a half early. But and then there was a fourth individual, Glenn Brunton, who played a minor role, who also was convicted. So four people are in prison because of this.
And it's not only just the fact that these suspects' families have been changed. It's really Ryan's parents as well. They are living in so much misery, and they talk about it a lot. They say, you know, this has been the worst experience of our life, and it's never going to be worse. Mom says she has no desire to live. Dad says that he wakes up often crying in the middle of the night or in the morning because he just has no way of moving past it. So I think it's this tragedy that it's not like it's going to get better for them. They don't think that it's ever going to get better. They just have to live with the guilt and the misery of losing their child.
And yet, even so, they both seem to have said that Ryan probably would have forgiven these people because she had so much compassion and love.
I watched that young woman give more of herself to her friends and family than anybody I've ever seen. She didn't have that expectation of reciprocity for all of those nice and kind deeds she did. It just made her feel good. So she just did it.
Ryan's dad, Joseph Lashley, is here with us today to talk about why Texas needs a Good Samaritan law. 34 states give drug users immunity from prosecution if they call 911 to report an overdose. Texas is not among them. What could this type of law have done for Ryan, do you think, Joe?
Well, if had any one of the four people involved in my daughter's death had picked up the phone at any time that Ryan was under the influence of the heroin they injected in her, she could have been saved with Narcan or any other type of anti-heroin medicine. I don't know what all different kinds there are, but they're out there.
So I'm going to ask Diane real quick, you know, what do these laws entail and why doesn't Texas have one? I mean, in this case, I mean, like Joe just said, Ryan could have been potentially saved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's no doubt she could have been saved.
Yeah.
There was an attempt last legislative session, last June, to get a Good Samaritan law passed, and it had wide support in the Texas State Legislature, and it would have given limited criminal immunity to Good Samaritans who call 911 to report a drug overdose, even if they were in possession of small amounts of illegal substances themselves. The bill was vetoed by our governor, Greg Abbott, and he wanted protections in the bill to prevent what he called its misuse by habitual drug abusers and drug dealers. And he put out a release on this at the time, and he wanted habitual drug users and dealers eliminated from the bill. And I talked to one of the big quarterbacks who was trying to get this bill through the ledge, and he said he'll try again.
So, Joe, I mean, Ryan wasn't a habitual heroin user. This was the first time. You know, so it does seem like if someone had been able to call at that point, she could have been saved. Have you thought any about how to really advocate for a law like this?
I've hired Pete Schulte. He's an attorney in Dallas, to explore different avenues. And now that the case is over, I'm meeting with him the end of next week when I get home, to speak further with him about it. The legal side of it, I don't know that much about. I just know the law doesn't exist, and it should. There's a website called Friends Don't Let Friends Die, and it's full of parents who have lost their children to heroin. Mm-hmm. And if you read some of the stories on there, almost every one of those children could have been saved had anyone picked up the phone and just called 911 and said that, you know, we have a person in distress here who's dying. But I think it's more of the people think that they'll get charged with some type of, you know, crime instead of being helpful to that person.
And Joseph, I remember when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that if any of these suspects had picked up the phone and called 911, that you would have considered them a hero as opposed to someone who contributed to your daughter's death. What do you have to say about their behavior when your daughter was there and in possibly in distress at John Davenport's house?
Well, I think what they did to my daughter was criminal, but I think that if James Coleman, being my age, and he was in the house around noon when my daughter was in distress, if he had picked up the phone, I don't care. I mean, he's a drug dealer. He's a bad person. But had he had picked up that phone and called 911 and said, you know, there's a child here that needs help, or had Sierra Rounce, who spent the whole day with my child from 12 to the ambulance was finally called at 8:30 p.m., you know, she could have gave my daughter a chance to live. And in my mind, everything up until that point of what they did to my daughter wouldn't have mattered to me, because she would still be here. I mean, I don't know what more to say about that. Catherine Dirks wrote me letters saying that had I been there, I could have saved Ryan. I would have saved Ryan. You know, but unfortunately none of them did. And you know, now I'm a father without a daughter because of this.
Yeah. It's really, I mean, it's a really devastating deal as an average person who, you know, isn't involved in a drug environment. You know, I would have assumed that if I saw a friend out, say at a party or something, in distress from a drug overdose, that I could have called 911. So, Kevin, what could this law do for someone like me who just would call and want to offer help to a friend?
Yeah, what the law, the most common form of this law basically means that you can call 911 to report an overdose, and you have to act in good faith. So you have to have a reasonable suspicion that there's an overdose, and you have to remain at the scene and help police and paramedics If you do so, then you will not be arrested or prosecuted if you happen to be in possession of drugs or be using drugs. And so, it gives people the freedom to call and hopefully save a life without having to worry about their own criminal liability.
So say I do call for a friend, and I'm not in possession of anything, but my friend is in possession of something, and there is this type of law. What would happen to my friend after the fact? Does this law would a law like this protect them as well, or is that a little unclear?
Yeah, it's a little unclear. It's typically the caller who's protected. So you might tell your friend to get lost and then make the call yourself. And
I agree exactly.
And I might add, if things play out in Grapevine as I think they are, then the person who is overdosing would not be criminally liable for having been in possession of a drug that nearly killed them.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much today for calling in, Joseph, and we really appreciate and so very sorry.
Let me add one thing, if that's okay. Detective
of
Eric
course.
Barnes. Who ultimately saved this case from being an OD? Hadn't these people robbed my daughter, or text back and forth plans to rob my daughter, this would have been listed as an OD. This would not have been a criminal case, and none of these people would have went to jail, which would have been a tragedy. Detective Barnes told me, he said out of 99% of the OD cases that he's ever dealt with, he comes to the house, and the one thing that's always common is the house is clean. It's almost like the people that do call, they spend more time cleaning up and covering their tracks than they do worried about the person who usually is a friend or somebody that they know, because they're too worried about what can happen to them. And that needs to change. I mean, people need to understand that these are lives. These are human beings that are dying, that are in distress. If I'm driving down the freeway and I see a person get hit by a car, and I don't stop and call the police, then I can be charged with failure to render aid. Why isn't those same laws apply to, even though there are illegal activities that these people are engaged in, it just doesn't make sense to me as a parent and as a person. And I don't understand why Greg Abbott, who I voted for, would veto something like this. Pete Schulte said that they call it a slippery slope in the Texas House, that there's a bunch of different reasons why they have a problem imposing this law, but it seems that you guys know of other states that have these laws in effect, and I bet they work. I mean, if something like this was passed, I bet maybe the amount of drugs that are used around here wouldn't lessen, but maybe the amount of deaths from these drugs would guaranteed would go down by a huge percentage. I mean, this isn't like dropping your friend off at the emergency room after they've been in distress for a long time. This is as simple as picking up the phone, calling 911, and saving somebody that maybe you had just met or maybe you've cared about for a long time. I think it takes between an hour to 3 hours for heroin to ultimately kill a person. And they have that long of a window to save that person's life. It only takes one phone call, just one phone call. I've read that the EMTs now actually carry Narcan with them when they, when they're out doing their rounds, when it's in the vehicle with them. And when a person's given Narcan, it counteracts the effects of heroin. I mean, 100%, it saves lives.
Right.
So,
right.
Anyways. Yeah.
No,
thank
those are excellent
me.
Points, and we really thank you for being on our show today.
Thank you, guys. Thank you all so all much.
Right. Thanks,
bye-bye.
Joseph.
All right,
thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
I want to once again thank Joseph Lashley for joining us today, and also thank you to my co-hosts, Diane Solis, Kevin Krause, and Naheed Rajwani. Remember, our show comes out every Thursday, so be sure to join us again next week. We're on iTunes, so subscribe to our channel, or tweet us at Texas Crime Cast. And remember to find more on all of our stories today and continuing coverage on DallasNews.com. A special thanks today to our producer, Tommy Noel. I'm Tasha Chaparis. Now here is Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto. Take it away, Mike.
There's crime, and there's crime with a capital C. You may decide where to rank the scourges as beer pong. No good, it seems, comes from this drinking game. First, it's Affluenza boy Ethan Couch exposed on Twitter, cheering on a beer pong game. Next, he's a fugitive headed to the border. Today, yes, big boy jail. Now we learn that what put a former Dallas Cowboy back in handcuffs in Wichita, Kansas. Joseph Randall was arrested last month after he tried to drive over three people outside a housewarming party. What set him off? You guessed it. Anger over a beer pong game. Or just Joseph being Joseph with him, who knows. And there was the First Lady and Secretary of State in beer pong battle on the Netflix serial House of Cards, but we digress. What's odd is that, like a lot of people, I managed to put down a few beers here and there without the pong and never got arrested. Coincidence? I think not. I may have deserved it once or twice, but that's not the point. No, the point is cause, effect, and bouncing a little white ball into a cup of beer, then drinking it. Once you start keeping score, all caution goes out the window. Don't blame the victim, but let's use our heads out there.